Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Hello everybody, and a warm welcome to another Motorsport Magazine podcast. And today we have, if I'm not very much mistaken, a man called Murray Walker with us at the Motorsport podcast table. Welcome, Murray.
Delighted to be here.
Now, there are a certain matters of housekeeping to go through before we speak to Murray, who, by the way, was driven up to London today in an Aston Martin Rapide by the very lucky Ed Foster.
Very rapidly, too.
Yeah, it wasn't difficult to wake up at 6 in the morning when you've got an Aston Martin sitting outside.
No, well, I wouldn't know. let me just...
Work hard.
yes, thank you, Murray. Just a moment, please. Let me tell you about our latest subscription offer, because this is vital to us, as you all know. And this one is a particularly good one, actually, because if you subscribe now, you will pay only, and it really is only, £46 for 1 year's Motorsport magazine. You will also get two free DVDs. One is the 1959 British Hill Climb Championship, and the other is 1960s British single-seater racing. Well, I would love to have that one. 1960s British single-seater racing. When was it better? Anyway, you get these two TV DVDs absolutely free of charge if you subscribe to Motorsport Magazine now. And the magazine itself will cost you just £46 for the year. Later, we will ask Damien Smith to tell us about our next Reader's Evening, which, of course, is to watch the Audi Le Mans film, and that's on October the 8th. But we'll come to Damien for that later. Murray, welcome. I would like to delve into your real DNA to start the ball rolling and ask you a motorcycling question. Because I've been loving watching Casey Stoner this season and intrigued by Rossi on the Ducati, which Stoner made a better job of the season before. What's been your take so far this year?
Sadly, Rob, motorcycle racing hasn't been as good this year as it has been in the recent past, for much the same sort of reason as Formula One has suffered, and that is that the electronics on the bikes now take care of everything. Mm. You don't get many wheelies these days. You don't get excess horsepower going through as a result of which they're sliding on the corners. They have to ride on a very tightly defined line to get the best out of the bikes, and it's not nearly as spectacular and dramatic as it used to be. Having said that, Casey Stoner did an absolutely superlative job with the Ducati, because Valentino Rossi, who has to be one of the greatest of all time, has demonstrated how incredibly difficult it is to ride and master, which Casey Stoner did with great aplomb. And he's showing how good he is now that he's with Honda, which is a better bike, and he's having a lot of success. But if I may carry on, I did an interview with Valentino Rossi last year at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, Motorcycle Grand Prix. I'd never met him before. I had this image of a nice chap. I sat in the Yamaha motorhome with him. He came in. He sat down opposite me at the table with his bright little face smiling at me, waiting for the question. I explained why I was there and what it was all about. I spent an absolutely enchanting 30 minutes talking to him. He's gigantically eloquent. He's enormously authoritative. He's unbelievably knowledgeable. he's a thoroughly nice bloke with a well-developed sense of humour, and I took to him enormously.
Yeah, I don't see how you couldn't take to Valentino Rossi, really. He's fantastic, isn't he? Nigel Roebuck is here with us, of course, and Ed Foster and Damien Smith. Nigel, the floor is yours.
Oh, well, I was just going to say to Murray, I mean, I wondered, have you met Stoner?
Yes, I have.
Because he strikes me as quite a sort of prickly character, but it fascinates me that only he seems to be able to ride a Ducati.
Well, I've met him once, to be honest, Nigel, and that was at the Honda motorhome when Honda was in Formula One, and I had the privilege of being their ambassador. And it was at Silverstone, and Casey came along because of his past affiliation with Honda. I thought he was a nice bloke, typical Aussie. I got on very well with him. Direct, blunt, straightforward. He wasn't as famous and successful then as he is now. And he has the reputation of being a bit prickly and of being extremely outspoken. Well, he is outspoken. And I suppose he's got every justification for being prickly. He's at the top of the pile, and he's done enormously well. But I've found over the years, and I'm sure you have, that all these top blokes, with very few exceptions, are decent human beings if you treat them decently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But do you have, just going back to this thing about Stoner and the Ducati, has anybody ever sort of put forward an explanation to you that makes sense as to why got on with it and even Rossi? Hayden, Melandri.
I typically rambled on and failed to answer the question.
No, it's all right.
Well,
no,
I didn't like to say so, Murray.
It's okay, don't worry.
So what was the question again?
It's just, what is it about Stoner that he made the Ducati work and Melandri couldn't, Hayden hasn't, Rossi isn't?
I suppose it's a combination of mechanical sympathy and massive balls. It can't be anything else, because Stoner's success with the Ducati was basically trusting the electronics and being prepared to come out of a corner and wind the twist grip round as far as it would go and let the anti-wheelie, anti-stall, anti-everything else kick and control the speed and horsepower that's going through to the back wheel. And the last thing I'd do is accuse Valentino Rossi of not being capable, but he obviously hasn't got that element that Casey Stoner's got. And it's like everything else with drivers and motorcycle riders. You've got to have the mechanical sympathy for whatever it is you're riding or driving, and Stoner's clearly got it.
And Rossi's always been very against all the electronic aids, hasn't he? You know, he's never enjoyed it, but, you know, a bit like Senna in Formula One, he hates it. He wants the bike to be a nice, pure mechanical machine rather than having all these, you know, helping hands.
Yes, and Ducati, of course, have got this characteristic this year that they've produced this very special bike, which in effect doesn't have a frame, because everything is bolted to the engine, and the between the engine and the headstock, there's this carbon fibre box. And nowadays, you've got to have an element of flexibility in the frame in order to get round the corners as quickly as possible, and the Ducati hasn't got it. And they've got a gigantic political problem now, because it looks as though in order to win in Grand Prix, they've got to do what all the others are doing, and that's having an aluminium beam frame, which is totally different to the philosophy that they're trying to develop in terms of the best possible road bikes.
Shall we?
Does that answer your question?
I think it pretty much does.
Yes. No, it does.
I'll let you know if it doesn't.
Thank you.
Shall we move on to something that, Murray, we've absolutely got to ask you about, and this is the decision that Formula One will be partly on Sky Television and partly on the BBC, when, of course, we all assumed that the BBC would stick to their contract and we would all be able to watch it free of charge every race. Now, this is not good news for a lot of fans.
Which way is the exit, Rob? Because I'm maybe
well, actually, we've
maybe needing it.
Actually, we've locked it.
I can speak with some experience here. Maybe not authority, but I can speak with some experience. I was lucky enough to do the commentary for the BBC when they started doing all the Formula One races in 1978. And then I was lucky enough to be adopted by ITV when BBC lost it. And there is no doubt about the fact that ITV did a better job than the BBC had been doing. And everybody now has got used to the BBC doing an even better job than ITV did. And I would challenge any organisation in the world to do a better job than the BBC is doing now, with Jake Humphrey, Eddie Jordan, David Coulthard, Martin Brundle, Ted Kravitz and Lee McKenzie. They're a wonderful combination. And Mark Wilkin, who does the production, does a fantastic job. The BBC are producing unequaled coverage. And naturally, everybody gets very exercised about the fact that they've now got to either pay for something through watching Sky that they've had free in the past, or they've got to be content with seeing 10 races live on BBC and wait for the others to be seen on the BBC as delayed highlights. I don't like it, Rob. Nobody likes it. And the BBC have had 80,000 protests or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But the facts of life are that the government has dramatically reduced the funding to the BBC. The BBC has got to make enormous economies. And rightly or wrongly, they have decided that they're going to make a massive economy on Formula One. But the alternative was for them to come out of it altogether. And half a loaf is better than no bread, and it's going to be more than half a loaf, because the worst that anybody is going to have to put up with is seeing 10 races live on the BBC and waiting to see the other 10, probably and possibly, with the complete race being shown. Well, it's not the end of the world. I'm not going to be very popular for saying all this, because a lot of people are going to have to shell out 400 quid or whatever Sky want to see all the races live. But it's tough, and I'm convinced that the time is rapidly coming, and you'll be able to comment on this, Nigel, where all sport is going to have to be paid for if you want to watch it on television. Yeah. It's the same with cricket now, it's the same with football, and in America it's everything.
Yeah, and in fact, in the column I cited one particular thing, which, the golf, the Masters, for the first time this year was shared between Sky and the BBC. And so, and what happened was that Sky did the whole, did all 4 days, and the BBC did the last two, but the two most important. And I should, one of the things that I'm just really fascinated by is what commentary teams each finishes up with. Well, because I watched the first 2 days of the Masters on Sky, and did not enjoy the commentary at all. It was essentially Colin Montgomery talking about himself. And I couldn't wait. And Peter Alliss in
did
golf.
Did you not like it because it was different or because it wasn't as good?
It was, both. Yeah. Both. It was different. And I didn't think it was as good. Technically, it was fine. But I just thought they've just spent a lot of money in assembling names, but they're actually not very good to listen to. And then Peter Alliss arrived finally back on Saturday and Sunday, and it was delightful.
But do you watch football and cricket?
I watch cricket. I strive to avoid football.
Did you approve of Sky coverage on cricket? Or
yes, it's okay. But I think, Murray, to a point, I've forgotten what it was like before it was on Sky now. Yeah. But they have David Gower.
I worry about it, Nigel, no end, because frankly, I find it difficult to imagine how anybody can do better than the BBC is doing now.
Yeah.
Not only in terms of the people that are presenting it that I've just talked about, but in terms of the time they get.
Absolutely.
Because you can see the practice on the red button with David Crofts and Anthony Davidson doing it, and they do it superbly.
Yeah.
You see the qualifying, you see the race, you see an hour before the race, you see about an hour and a half after the race. And I find it difficult to believe that Sky are going to be doing better than that. And the British don't like change, and won't want somebody other than Martin Brundle and David Coulthard doing it.
No.
Notwithstanding the fact that they're doing it for the first time this year together. They do it consummately well, and everybody's got used to them and admires and respects them.
Mm. Sorry, Murray. I don't think we should dwell too long on this subject, simply because it really does affect the UK and Australia in the main, whereas we're talking globally on our podcast.
Righto then.
If I could just make
one point, actually, Murray, just to pick up on something you mentioned. Of course, you know, there is an entire generation, and more than one generation, which has never known anything other than every Grand Prix being on TV live in its entirety else.
That's me.
But as you were saying, 1978, you know... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're absolutely right. But you're talking about 1978. Now, that was actually the first year that every Grand Prix was on live.
Yeah.
And I can remember that when there were sort of two or three a year, and only bits of them, you know, so you would... A bit of Formula 1, bit of show jumping.
I remember being at Monza one year. I'm terrible on remembering which years. It was the year that Jackie Stewart won by a hair's breadth. There were two fixed cameras, Nigel.
Yeah.
One of them was on the Mussolini grandstand looking down towards the Parabolica, and it was a fixed camera. Mm-hmm. And the other was at the Lesmo Benz. Mm. And so the lap, you couldn't see who was competing. And I had to just fill in.
Was that a problem, Murray?
Not really. No.
Wrong. You mentioned Half a Loaf, and I mean, I remember watching those races on the BBC, and the thing was, it was so much better than nothing.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. Well, it's true. Well, it's true. All I'm saying is, it's perhaps a little bit easier to accept what's happening now if you have been through the time when you've really gotten down all, or hardly. Yeah.
Okay. The Formula One season so far... Fantastic performance again from Adrian Newey, isn't it? I mean, the man is remarkable, isn't he?
Well, yes, he is. I mean, he did it in America, he did it with Williams, he did it with McLaren, and now he's done it again with Red Bull. I get very intolerant and exercised about people who say that Red Bull shouldn't be in Formula One, they're only a soft drinks manufacturer, and how dare they beat the likes of McLaren and Ferrari and Mercedes. The fact is that they've done a better job than anybody else, and they've done it because Dieter Mateschitz, the boss of Red Bull and the money bags, has had the courage of his convictions and has put his money where his mouth is. Yeah. And we all know that if you've got enough money in Formula One, you can get the right people. And if you give them the right facilities and enough time, both things they need, they'll produce a winning team. And that's what he's done. And good luck to him.
Murray, we don't see many team principals come in into the sport and have an impact the way that Christian Horner has at Red Bull. I mean, I think he deserves a lot of credit for galvanising what was essentially originally Jaguar Racing, a very underperforming team, and within 5 years make them world champion. What do you make of Christian?
I think, first of all, he's a lovely bloke, and secondly, he's a quite incredible person. He was no mean driver himself, as you well know, and he had his own Arden team. And now, as you rightly say, he's built up Red Bull from nothing by employing the right people and giving them the right direction and the right encouragement. And Formula One, we all know, is a collection of outstanding people, no matter what you do, whether you're a mechanic putting on the wheels or whether you are one of the people doing the telemetry or whether you're a team principal or whether you're a designer, you are the best at what you do in a very fast-moving, colourful, high-stepping sport. And the difficulty is to get the right people and get them to work together. Nigel, you will remember the Force team.
I do.
Where there was a heck of a lot of American money.
Yes.
And they had Ross Brawn and people like that.
They had, well, in fact, they had Ross and Adrian at the same time at one point, didn't they?
And Neil Oatley.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
No.
Why didn't it work?
Well, it was for a start. It was instant and it was artificial. I mean, there were also people there like Tyler Alexander, you know.
Right.
So very, very experienced people. But it was a sort of. I mean, to me, Murray, it was the Formula One what Manchester City or Chelsea are, which is sort of, in other words, you know, well, I mean, the old saying from Indy in the 50s was, you know, the team owner saying, well, how much is it going to cost you? And the chief mechanic's answer was, well, how fast do you want to go?
My George.
And they spend the money, but they just assumed that by assembling enough talent,
yes, that's right.
that would be enough.
But Carl Haas was no mug, was he?
No, he wasn't. But what he didn't have was any experience of Formula One. Yeah. And in fact, the Formula One project was actually on the back of the IndyCar project was done. Well, do you remember it was Beatrice? The company's called Beatrice, yeah, Foods. It was a massive, massive, yes, company. And the chairman was a racing fan. Yeah. And he actually said to Carl, well, if we're doing this, well, why don't we have a Formula One team as well? So Carl sort of said, well, all right. So a huge amount of money was spent, but in effect, it was kind of thrown together.
I was going to say, I said to Ed coming up in the car today, there was a time when I thought if I had a massive amount of money, I would love to have my own Formula One team. I now know that if I had a massive amount of money, the last thing on earth I would want is my own. Can you imagine being up against Eddie Jordan, Frank Williams, Ron Dennis? They would have cut me to ribbons.
It's also a very rapid way to have a very little bit of money
to make a small fortune.
I guess you. I guess you could say the same things about the BAR team in many ways, couldn't you?
You know, yeah, there were similarities, weren't there, Murray?
Yes.
And Toyota, yeah, to a certain extent.
Yes. And Toyota, to a certain extent. Yeah. I mean, just proving that money is not everything, which actually underlines what we're saying about Christian Horner.
Where did BAR go wrong? Because Craig Pollock sweet-talked British American Tobacco into divvying up a great deal of money, so that wasn't the problem. They had the premises. Adrian Reynard's place, which was BAR, which became Honda, which is Mercedes-Benz, and it's the same, people working there.
The same vast palace.
So where did BAR go wrong?
I don't know. I mean, the BAR story that always comes to mind whenever I think of them, that first year, I think we got to, I can't remember if it was Hockenheim or Nürburgring, but it was the German Grand Prix. We were there. We were there in practice, and somebody told me that the BAR motorhome actually had 28 phone lines, which took a bit of believing. It was certainly the biggest motorhome in the paddock at that time, without a doubt. And I said to Bernie, "That motorhome. I'm told that motorhome's got 28 phone lines." Murray said, "Well, they probably need it." And I said, "Well, why would they need it?" He said, "Well, just in case 28 people ring up at the same time to see if they scored a point." Yeah.
Oh, we will miss Bernie Ecclestone, won't we? We will.
Yeah. You always talk so quietly, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He said to me once, "I don't make money, I do deals."
Yes, that's
right. And I really do think that for Bernie, the money is a byproduct of the deal.
Yeah.
Because he wants to win the deal.
Oh, absolutely.
And I would hate to be up against him.
Well, he still gets a kick out of it, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. as much as ever.
Yeah. Murray, here's a question. I mean, what happens after Bernie Ecclestone? Yeah, you will have a view on this.
I said to him once, "Bernie, I said, you're responsible for Formula One being what it is. Now it was an amateur sport and you never knew whether Ferrari were going to turn up. It's now highly professional. It's all down to you. What's going to happen when you go?" "I'm not planning to leave," he said. Yes. So what's going to happen? I don't know, Rob. It'll be some sort of a committee, inevitably, won't it? And we know what happens with committees. They set out to produce a horse and a camel.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe. I mean,
it's amazing for
us. You can't see another single individual, though, Murray, can you? I can't, anyway.
No one would have the authority, would they?
To carry the authority over the years, and I can't. No.
Christian Horner.
Well, I admire Christian as much as Murray does.
Let's try a few.
Yeah.
Ron Dennis?
No.
Why
not?
Because I think that he...
Too inflexible.
Yes, and having gone through the problems he went through a few years ago, I don't think he could come back and run it. Do you?
No.
I think he's too divisive as well, I think.
Flavio Briatore.
Would be amusing.
Well, in terms of doing deals in a money sense, yeah. After Bernie, that would be the first guy I would think of.
Would he be top of your list if you had a choice? Do you think?
It'd be difficult now, in light of events in the recent past. But
why couldn't Formula One?
But I think if you're talking in terms of simply doing deals. I mean, there's a reason why Bernie and Flav are such friends and always have been, because they've done a lot of deals together. And if Bernie admires Flav's way of doing deals, then it must be pretty good.
Nigel, you're extremely knowledgeable about the American motor racing scene.
Mm.
And am I not right in saying that where what I think of as CART had gone down the mine and disappeared without trace, some bloke who was in charge of the American Rough Riding Rodeo Association has come in and is turning it round? In other words, why can't a complete stranger come in?
It's not impossible, Murray. And in fact, Jackie Stewart has long said that ideally that's what Formula One needs.
Yeah.
Post-Bernie. He's always said maybe somebody who's never had any connection with racing but is a supreme businessman.
There's a name, Jackie Stewart. I mean, he's been there and done that, he's made a bob or two out of Formula One.
He's made a bob or two, yes. But I think he'd probably eat a razor blade before he'd volunteer for a job like that, Murray.
You think he wouldn't need it somehow?
No. I think being chairman of the BRDC probably cured JYS being the man at the helm.
Actually, that
Martin Brundle.
Again, not impossible. But you see, the first thing he would say to me, too nice a bloke.
Yes, that is a problem, of course.
Yeah. Actually, Rob, Christian Horner is not a daft idea.
I think he would be my favourite. But what I'd like to know is, why can't Formula One be run like all other global sports at the top level? Why can't it be run, why does it have to be run by an individual? I just don't get it.
Well, it wouldn't be run by an individual, but you still need a front man, don't you?
The front man, yeah.
Even if there's a chairman of the board, basically.
Because it always has been Rob, and because he's done a consummate job, and because the best way to run any organisation is to have a benevolent dictator in charge of it. I don't know how benevolent Bernie is, but he's certainly...
But I think there's one... Bernie, the other special quality you see that Bernie has and will always have, and which nobody taking over could ever have, is that when Bernie first, in effect, unionised, formed FOCA, or FICA, as it was originally, and just said to the teams... Look, instead of us all doing our individual deals with the organisers, I'll deal for everybody. And they were very happy to let him do it. What you have to remember is that Bernie made a lot of people hugely rich.
Yeah.
But they were not before.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now they are all hugely rich. And it's a situation that's existed for a long time. They know nothing else. They think of nothing else. But there's nobody else could ever, I don't think, have quite the hold on them that Bernie has, because Bernie is the reason they are rich.
Yeah. Is there a worst nightmare, all the teams running it?
I think if you look in the end at what happened to CART,
The prime example.
Because there was a time when CART was the best racing series on earth, I thought.
And Bernie is a racer at heart.
No question about him.
He has got the sport at heart, and we all know that he has done all sorts of generous things for the sport that people in general don't know about.
Yeah, that's true.
Murray, when we announced on Twitter, is it Ed? Is it Twitter?
That's what it's called. Twitter. We're a very modern magazine here. Thanks, Rob.
Are you a tweeter? Murray?
Not over my dead body, Rob. I'm not a tweeter and I'm not a Facebooker, but I'm an old chap and I'm not so closely in touch with all the modern technology people are.
Thank God.
I'm
not much of a tweeter myself, actually, I must say. But what is amazing is it went mad when we announced that Murray Walker was coming on our podcast. You know, the thing sort of exploded. And so I'd like to pass on some of the questions to you. And I like this one, which the trouble is I haven't brought my reading glasses, so I'm just padding while I find where this question is. I may not even have the right page. Oh, here it is, yes. Do you still get excited on Friday morning when you're at home and you know that you can put the television on and see the cars come out?
I don't know that excited is quite the right word. I certainly look forward enormously to the fact that I'm going to be able to listen to David Croft and Anthony Davidson on the Red Button talking about the practice, and then that I'm going to be able to listen to the television team talking about all the rest of it. Because the commentating wasn't a job, as far as I was concerned, Rob. My wife says I've never done a day's work in the whole of my life because I've always enjoyed immensely what I did. I like to think of myself as an enthusiast who was lucky enough to be able to be talking to people about that which they loved and I loved.
Sure. And also you've been responsible. I mean, as Matt 79 says here, many of us, he says, owe our passion for Formula One to you.
Yeah, I was very lucky, Rob, because when I started, I mean, I did a few Grand Prix that Raymond Baxter didn't do before 1978 when the BBC started doing all of them. And at that time, there was only one broadcaster, and it was the BBC. So if you were the BBC's man, by definition, you were the man. And basically, if you satisfied your producer and your masters at the BBC, you were all right. And it's going to be very difficult for anybody in any sport, not just Formula One, to get as well known as the BBC commentators like Peter Allis, David Coleman, Harry Carpenter, the tennis, Dan Maskell, you know, so many of them, because they had an exclusive. But nowadays, there's BBC, ITV, Channel 5, Sky, umpteen different commentators, each with a very small share of the market. So it's going to be very difficult for any one person to have the privilege and advantage that I had.
Murray, you mentioned some of the great names of sports commentary in other areas. What do you think about the rise of the expert commentators today? I mean, you know, previously they were broadcasters first. These days they're sportsmen who become commentators and experts. What do you think of that trend?
When in 1980, Damien, Jonathan Martin, who was the head of sport of BBC television, said to me, there's going to be two commentators in future, Murray. You'll be one and James Hunt will be the other. And I thought, I thought, James Hunt? I thought, what the hell does he know about commentary? He's a racing driver. And I also thought that this was the thin end of the wedge to get me out and Hunt in. And as a result of that, there was a fair amount of friction in the commentary box between James and I until we learned to live with each other. But the idea of having a pundit who knows what he's talking about because he's been there and done that successfully is an extremely good one for all sorts of reasons. It gives the viewer two different voices. It gives the viewer two different points of view. It gives the viewer something that most commentators haven't got, and that's knowledge and experience of actually having done it. And if the combination works, as it did, I believe, with James and myself, and subsequently with Martin and myself, it's an enormous benefit. Mm. But the problem is finding the pundit who can do it. Because you've been there and done that doesn't mean to say that you can talk about it knowledgeably, authoritatively, and hopefully entertainingly. Now, James Hunt could and did. Martin Brundle could and does. David Coulthard, most certainly. I mean, David Coulthard has been an absolute eye-opener to me. I think he's done a fantastic job. So if it works, if it's great. If it doesn't, it isn't. But if it doesn't work, the pundit doesn't last very long.
But the interesting thing, of course, with Martin is I think we're lucky to have him in a way, because he could have been a broadcaster before being a racing driver. The way he's grown into broadcasting, you know, but to have a pundit who becomes the lead commentator and actually holds the program together, that's something else, isn't it?
Yes. He always jokes that his racing career was just in preparation for his broadcasting career.
But I don't know what it is. For whatever reason, James Allen, who followed me, and Jonathan Ledyard, who'd followed James, both of whom are extremely nice people, both of whom are extremely eloquent, both of whom are extremely knowledgeable and experienced, for whatever reason, didn't click with the British public. And I don't know what it is that enables you to click. And Martin Brundle and David Coulthard have most certainly done so. It's a combination of respect and admiration of their personalities, I think.
Do you not think also, Murray, that there is something that makes someone a broadcaster or not? It's that almost intangible thing. I mean, for example, Martin Brundle just took to it like a duck to water, didn't he?
Yes, he did. But it's partly having the knowledge of what you're talking about, which is extremely important. It's partly having the ability to talk about it, which is essential, because you've been there and done that doesn't mean to say that you can talk about it. I mean, in the past, who could have been theoretically a better commentator to talk about athletics than Roger Bannister, first chap to run the 4-minute mile, but he was not a success. And it's not a criticism of him, because you can drive a car quickly, it doesn't mean to say that you're also a stand-up comedian on the box. But to some extent, you have to be.
I think also it's there's a quality in some voices and it's not there in others. And I always, Murray, thought your true genius was making an inordinately dull afternoon seem exciting. And I still don't know how you were able to do that.
You know, I mean, I like to think of myself.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As a passionate enthusiast who's very lucky to be where he is when he's talking into a microphone and trying to interpret the pictures that the viewer is looking at. And it was a passion. It still is. You are extremely lucky to be there.
I know it's true. But I remember it was one year at Barcelona when literally nobody passed anybody all day long. They just droned around. And I remember, and you came into the press room afterwards, and I said, "What do you think?" And you sort of said, "Well, that was hard going, wasn't it?" Then my wife recorded it for me, which she always has and always does. And I got home and watched it, and I sort of thought, "I can't believe this. I was there. It wasn't like this.
It wasn't this exciting."
Yes, but you know as well as I do that there is no such thing as a dull Formula One race. It may be processional, but it's not dull. And if you know what to look for, yeah, there is true. Always something exciting that you can talk it's about. True. Like, talking about Spain, Emilio de Villota getting in the way of James Hunt.
Yes.
And what was going to happen to Emilio Villota when James Hunt got out of the car? And it did.
Also, Murray, those are the days when you really earn your money, aren't they? I mean, it's much easier to commentate on a thrilling race.
Yes, it is. It is, Rob. But if you, it's like everything. If you like what you're doing, you are going to be enthusiastic about it.
Sure.
Yeah.
We've got so many questions to get through. I think we've had a record number of questions. But Tony Garan Murray wants to know what you think James would have thought of DRS and KERS and all these various tyres that we're faced with each weekend.
I don't know. I suspect that James would have been swingingly critical and dismissive of them as being artificial aids which detracted from the skill of the driver. But sadly or not, we're Formula One in show business, and what most of the public want to see is something exciting, and most of the public are not rabid and knowledgeable enthusiasts like what we are.
We are. And all the people who are listening to us today. Fantastic. Couple more questions, Murray. This is quite a tough one, actually. It comes from Juliet Armstrong, and she wants to know, what was the most exciting moment, I'm going to say this slowly to give you time to him, the moment you ever commentated on in Formula One? You know, might it have been Damon Hill winning the championship or Nigel Mansell's puncture in Australia?
I thought, coming from Juliet Armstrong, it was going to be, why aren't there more women in Formula One? However, this is a much easier question. The most exciting to me, I think, was Nigel Mansell passing Nelson Piquet in the 1987 British Grand Prix, because you had the home hero against the villain from Brazil, and they hated each other's guts, and they were the only two people in the race, and Nigel drove an absolute blinder. Second to that would both be Damon Hill in 94 at Suzuka when it was a two-part race.
Extraordinary race that was.
He won by, I remember saying, 3.4 seconds, fantastic. I don't know, there's so many of them, Rob. Schumacher and Villeneuve colliding was pretty exciting at Jerez.
One of the most bizarre ones I remember doing, because I must admit I'm a child of the 80s, so I grew up watching Grand Prix on a Sunday night, and the Mexican Grand Prix one year, and I assume you were commentating from London for that one, and you had to go from we watched the start of the race as a highlights thing, and then suddenly it switched to live. Do you remember that one?
I can't remember, Damien. Some of them we actually did from Mexico. I mean, the 86, I think it was, when Nigel came to, it's my birthday, and Nigel came to my birthday party, and he said, I'm not going to eat anything, Murray, because I'm driving in the race tomorrow. So, qualifying. And to cut a long story short, he had a slice of beef and a bread roll. And the next day, he had Montezuma's Revenge. And you remember in those days, Nigel, they used to paint arrows on the pits approach to indicate to the driver where he had to stop. And the Williams mechanic painted a bent arrow with the word toilet.
Yeah. That's right.
I got a feeling that I haven't answered the question again. I really don't think it matters, actually.
That's a better story, anyway.
I think Williams mechanic humour is just fine, actually. We ought to ask you, really, about what's been going on at Williams, Murray, because we're all big fans, I think. I think I can say we're all big fans of the team, and it's been sad to see, hasn't it?
It's been, I would put it more strongly than that, Rob. I would say it's been absolutely tragic, because I think rightly regard Williams as one of the greatest Formula One teams of all time. I have the most gigantic admiration and respect for Frank Williams and Patrick Head and the organisation they built. They've had enormous success, and now, as I speak to you, they've scored 4 points in this season, and they're down the mine with the HRTs of this world.
Yeah.
And the brutal truth, for whatever reason, and I don't know whether it's political or practical, I don't believe it's budget, is that they haven't done a good enough job, and they can't have done a good enough job because they haven't got the right people in the right places. Is that a fair comment? I mean, I hate having to say it, but Formula One is the toughest and most ruthless business I have ever come across in my life. And I was in the advertising business, and I thought that was pretty tough. But it's a kid's tea party compared with Formula One. But I hope to live to see the time when Williams, under their new leadership, are back at the top again.
We have a question from Alistair Warren about the two Lotus teams on the grid, Murray, and I'm keen to hear what your view on that is. I mean, I think most of us around the table feel that Lotus stopped with Colin Chapman.
I have a very strong point of view on that, which you have just expressed. In my opinion, and I have the greatest admiration for what is they're trying to do with Lotus, but in my opinion, no team nowadays is entitled to call itself Lotus, because Lotus to me was Colin Chapman and Jim Clark, and arguably, to some extent, Peter Waugh and Ayrton Senna. But it certainly stopped being Lotus in 1987, if not earlier. And I really don't know why they want to call themselves Lotus, because I would have enormous respect for Tony Fernandez if he'd started a new team and called it Air Asia. Yeah,
why does it have to be called Lotus?
Why does it have to be called Lotus?
I entirely agree.
Yes.
Well, I think it's people mistakenly thinking that it gives them credibility, is what I think.
Well, yes. An awful lot, again, I don't mean this unkindly, but an awful lot of the people who are watching and enjoying Formula One now know nothing about its history. And Lotus and Colin Chapman and even Ayrton Senna are completely meaningless to them now. So what reputation and historical association has Team Lotus got with what was Colin Chapman's organisation? Nothing.
Murray, you mentioned that people not knowing about history. In the car on the way up, you were telling that story of the Schumacher fan who came up to you.
I live near a little country town, and a bloke came up to me and said, Murray, he said, that Michael Schumacher is the greatest driver that's ever lived. I said, hang on. I said, he's bloody good. But I said, what about Anuvolari, Caracciola, Ben Rosemar, Jim Clark, Alberto Ascari? Never heard of them, he said. And what he meant was that Michael Schumacher is the greatest driver that's ever lived that I've heard of.
Yes.
Because
yes.
He had no historical knowledge. And I'm not saying this critically or destructively. Michael Schumacher actually had little or no interest or knowledge of the historical greatness of Ferrari when he joined them.
Absolutely.
But in your advertising career, you'd have probably said he was probably the best racing driver in the world.
We didn't have the privilege of handling Carlsberg, but Double Diamond we did.
Other beers
works wonders, you will recall.
And other beers are available.
What happened to Double Diamond? That transition period for you must have been amazing. When the BBC started doing every race and you became the commentator regularly rather than...
Yes, what a lot of people didn't realise, Damien, was we didn't actually go to a lot of the races, the long-haul ones, like Brazil, Japan, South Africa. We would be doing from a studio in Shepherd's Bush. in an enormous barn-like studio, and if you were doing the Japanese Grand Prix, you went in at 4 o'clock in the morning, and there was just a monitor in the middle of this vast room, and you had to try to talk knowledgeably, enthusiastically, and hopefully entertainingly about something that was happening live. You couldn't say we're not there.
No.
Because obviously the public was saying, well, if they're not there, how can they talk about it? Mm. By the same token, you couldn't say we are there, because that would be lying. So you used to say things like, I can't actually see the pits from my commentary position, which was perfectly true, because you were 8,000 miles away. And I remember James Hunt. You can't talk about Formula One and TV very long without talking about James. James tended to have a very strong opinion about anything, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he had a particularly strong opinion about apartheid in South Africa. And we were doing the South African Grand Prix from Shepherd's Bush, and all of a sudden, for no reason at all, James starts banging on about the evils of apartheid, which actually hadn't got a great deal to do with the South African Grand Prix and wasn't doing the BBC politically much good either. And Mark Wilkin, who was producing the programme, writes a note and passes it to James, and it said, "Talk about the race." So James says, "Well, anyway, thank God we're not there."
Right. Well, do you know what? I think television really needs people like that. I do. I think it's good old James. And he was great with you. You were great together, weren't you? You were great team.
Trouble
together.
With Jabber, he's a French Wally, always has been and always will be.
Yes, that's right. And for Tracy, ye gods, I mean, as soon as he started talking about Ricardo, he used to...
But I always knew if I said there's no such thing as a dull Grand Prix. You could have processional ones. And if we had a processional one, and there wasn't a great deal to say about it, I knew that I only had to say something complimentary about Ricardo Patrese. and we shared one microphone between the two of us, so you had to actually yield the microphone for the other bloke to talk. James would furiously gesticulate at me, and I would give him the microphone, and he would then pour vitriol and bile on Ricardo Patrese, who he quite wrongly regarded as being responsible for the death of Ronnie Peterson Monza in 1978.
Yeah.
But as I say, James had a fixed opinion about things and nothing would change them. Which wasn't nearly as bad as him actually not turning up to do the commentary. It happened in Belgium one year. Mm-hmm. And I was frantically like, "Where's James? Where's James?" And he never turned up. And we were getting Johnny Herbert in and anybody that had retired to help out. And James came up afterwards and apologised for not being there on account of the fact that he'd been in bed with a stomach complaint. And I thought, it's the first time I've ever heard it called that.
In fact, I think there were two stomach complaints.
Allegedly. Family show. This is Motorsport Magazine. Anyway, wonderful stories, Murray, as ever. Thank you so much. We've actually taken another question. And this comes from South Africa. It comes from Gary in Kyalami Hills. And he wants to talk to you about noise, Murray. And it's something we've discussed on this podcast before. We don't want quiet little turbo engines in Grand Prix racing, do we?
Maybe not, Rob. If ever I talk to somebody who's been to a Grand Prix for the first time, did you enjoy it? Yes, I did. What impressed you most? Oh, the noise. It's always the noise. Mm. So, yes, noise is an integral part of Formula One. But, Nigel, Damien, when we had 1.5-litre Coventry Climax engines in 19, whenever it was, and Jim Clark was winning and Graham Hill was winning and Jackie Stewart was winning, and they weren't making the 19,000 RPM noise,
did we
complain?
No, we didn't. It was actually quite a nice noise, Murray. I mean, it wasn't anything like the sort of the volume and intensity of the engines today. But no, that is a fair point.
I think the V6s, Rob, will make a nice a V6 at 15,000 RPM, which is what it's going to be.
You see, I always like the sound of the turbo engines first time round, Murray.
Yes.
You know, the tag and the Honda. Yes. I thought it was a nice sound.
I mean, visually and audially, no. What's the word? Never mind.
Orally.
Orally.
AU.
Room for the journalists.
The showers of sparks from the titanium skid plates, mm-hmm. accompanied by chattering wastegates, were a really exciting time.
That's true.
The most exciting time, I reckon.
Yeah. I've always wondered, actually, about that 61 season when you went from... went to 1.5 litre mm-hmm. Grand Prix cars. Do you remember any sort of backlash from the public as such in those times that people were
I was only a kid, and I mean I was going to odd races. I remember it was massively unpopular with the drivers.
Yeah,
they really hated it. 1.5 litres unsupercharged,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
160 brake horsepower Formula One car.
Yeah. Yeah.
Joke.
But it was a great time. Graham Hill, Jackie Stewart, Jim Clark.
There was some great racing. I must say, Murray, whenever I'm at the Festival of Speed or something, if you see a Lotus 25 now or something like that, you really cannot get over how tiny they were. Little jewels, absolutely. But,
fantastic.
But very little.
Yeah, they were.
But we've gone from such a change from, you know, from 1958, say, in a van wall monster of a car.
But again, you know, it's how you perceive things rather than how things really are. I mean, when I was very young, I was my parents took me to the Gold Cup at Alton Park in 1955, and there were two. It was a very, very good entry. There were two Lancias D50s that had been taken over by Ferrari. And they were being driven by Hawthorne and Castellotti, and I was there with my dad and came upon these cars, and I mean, I thought they seemed terrifying in a way. They were massive, they seemed to me. Go to Goodwood now and look at a D50 in the paddock, and you think it's actually a very small car.
Yeah.
Yes.
And in photographs, it looks huge.
Yes.
When it's not in proportion to anything else, but when you actually see it, it's not a big car at all.
That was one of the great might have beens of all time, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely.
If they had time to develop that car,
and the Vascari hadn't
been
killed.
It would have been terrific.
Yeah. That's true.
What did you think about Mike Hawthorne as a bloke?
Well, I never knew him, obviously. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people absolutely adored him in the same way that people adored Innes, sort of hail fellow, well met, and all the rest of it. I must say also that I've met people who were contemporaries of my
who regarded him as like an objectionable boor. Yes.
Exactly right. Yes. Just thought he was a yahoo.
Yeah.
And I'm interested. You asked me
much the same. I mean, there's the image of the flat cap, bow tie, pint of beer in hand, hail fellow, well met. Yeah. But he could be pretty outrageously unacceptable. Mm. Apropos of nothing, one of the great books of all time is Mon Ami Mate, Chris Nixon wrote about the Hawthorne Peter Collins Association.
Yes.
I would always recommend that as a great book if you want to know something about the history of the sport.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, isn't that the next project for the people who did the Senna film? The people who made the Senna film, the documentary.
Oh, yes.
The next project, I understand, is not a documentary, but a feature film about, Mon Ami Mate, about the friendship between those two.
Yes.
There's also going to be...
And, there's the Lauda Hunt one, which is being made.
Hmm. It's all the rage.
Certainly racing is very much in vogue for movies.
Absolutely.
Well, there have been two fabulous films this year for motorsport enthusiasts. One is the Senna one. Which I say, even if you are totally disinterested in motor racing and Formula One, you must see, because it's about an incredible man rather than an incredible sport. And the other one was the TT film, Closer
which
to the
I
Edge.
Which I still haven't seen, and I'm desperate to see.
Yeah, as good as, if not better than, if you're a motorcycle racing enthusiast, than the Senna film, and right. I can think of no higher praise. Right. It is incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So everybody says.
I've actually seen it twice now.
Yeah.
It was even better the second time.
Really?
Always think if you see a film twice in the spaces of a month, and it's better the second time, and then it's a really good film.
Yeah.
This is the perfect moment for our editor, Damien Smith, to tell everybody about our own Motorsport Magazine film evening. Damien, on...
Yes, we had a great film evening early in the year with the Senna film, and it went down very well with the people who joined us. We thought we'd try and find another idea to do something similar. There's a film called Truth in 24, which was made by Audi to basically follow fly-on-the-wall style the team through the 2008 Le Mans 24 Hours. Now, I have to admit, I missed this first time around. It just bypassed me. It wasn't released in the UK. It did have a US release, I understand. And I kept hearing about this film, and Alan McNish told me about it and said how fabulous it was. The PR guy at Audi UK, Martin Pass, was telling me about it. It sounded fantastic. So anyway, I managed to get a copy of it. Sat down and watched this film. I was expecting a bit of a corporate kind of Audi film, uh-huh. Very much the corporate line. It's not. It's absolutely not. It's a really fascinating insight into the workings of a modern race team. And it follows the team through the preparations for Le Mans and at Le Mans itself. And that race happened to be a very dramatic one in the battle with Peugeot. And it comes to a fantastic climax at the end. And I think in terms of seeing how a modern race team works and how the human element is so important in a race team, I haven't seen a better documentary.
It really is fly on the wall, isn't it?
It is,
that's
the point.
Yeah.
Sounds
great.
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
It's
well,
wonderful.
That's
a
bit of Alan McNish in it,
isn't it? Lovely bloke. Yes, he
lovely
is.
Bloke.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Great guy.
So what we've organised is an evening, Saturday, October the 8th, at the Audi Quattro Rooms, which is the big glass dealership on the A4. When you come into London on the A4, it's on the left-hand side. It's a spectacular building, and they've got great facilities there for this sort of event. We're going to show the film, and then the best part for me is not only do you get to see the film, afterwards Alan McNish, Tom Christensen are going to be there on the night. The engineers, Howden H. Haynes, who does steal the show somewhat in the film, who was the lead engineer on the winning car that year, on McNish's and Christensen car, and also Lena Gade, who worked on that car as well, and this year was the winning engineer with the Audi R18 at Le Mans. So two engineers, two of the greatest Le Mans drivers we've ever seen in the room. So we'll have a forum after the film and discussion. Audience members obviously can participate asking questions. It should be a really good evening, so I'm really looking forward to it. So it's Saturday, October the 8th.
Good. I mean, if you're listening in Mexico or Mongolia, you won't know where the Audi place is. But if you're listening in England, I suggest you buy your ticket right now.
I passed it on the way here this morning.
We did indeed.
It's going to be a great evening. Yeah, passed it at great speed in the Aston Martin Rapide.
Well within the legal limit.
But there's details in the magazine this month, the new issue, the October issue, which is on sale this week. And you can also go on the website as well. Okay. To find out
more
about it. I've
got enormous respect for Audi when you think of what they've done, rallying with the Quattro, British Touring Car Championship, DTM, and of course Le Mans.
They do things so well.
Yeah. Ulrich.
He's a really interesting man, actually, because hugely successful guy in motor racing terms, what he's managed to achieve with Audi. Yeah. He doesn't always come across as a great character because he's a little bit cold in terms of the public perception. But when you actually meet him and talk to him, he's a really warm character who really loves his motor racing. And
I must confess, I was in Montreal this year, Le Mans weekend.
Mm.
And I remember, it was the Saturday afternoon when suddenly the word came in that McNish had a huge accident and, didn't look very good. I mean, initially it really didn't look very good, did it?
No, not at all.
Sorry,
I was going to say was, but I can't even remember how I did it now, but anyway, on my laptop, I made some connection to to Le Mans. And but here I'm in the Montreal press room. Everybody's, you know, watching what's happening in France. But I remember Ulrich's face when Alan got out of the car.
Hmm.
And that was the, when he saw that Alan was all right.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, it, talk about it, was the only thing that mattered. I mean,
absolutely.
It's, yeah, it's, in terms of spectacle.
Yeah, but it really came across as a sort of, it is very much a family outfit.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
They're very close. I mean, Alan says he's...
In a way that a lot of Formula One teams are not.
No.
Can you see the VW group getting involved with Formula One?
I don't know, Murray. I think it probably, if they'd stuck with the, thank God they didn't, but if they had stuck with the original four-cylinder turbo, I think maybe. Because, I mean, that was actually originally conceived for Audi.
Yes, yeah. Well, yes.
Because Audi sort of said, well, if it's a four-cylinder turbo, yeah, we'll be there.
Well, I interviewed,
and then they changed their mind.
I interviewed Ulrich Beretsky, who's the engine guy at Audi earlier this year, and he caused a bit of a stink with our readers because he said noise doesn't matter for racing cars. But, he said to me that he was part of the panel that came up with the Formula One rules.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the original rules. Oh. So they were clearly at the centre of the decision making. And I think that there was definitely scope there. Whether it's still open now with the V6, I don't know. But
it might be.
I still think there's a possibility within the next 5 years VW will come in one shape or another with one of their brands.
Yeah.
Speaking of Alan McNish, I think Sky Television could do a lot worse than telephone Alan McNish. I think he'd make a brilliant contribution.
He would indeed, but he's still busy in three years' time.
He's like Anthony Davidson, isn't he? He's got other fish to fry, and they're more important.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, when he stops being busy driving racing cars very fast, he'll be a brilliant TV guy.
Yeah. He will. Yeah. Shall we finish up by each of us asking Murray our own little question? Maybe something we always wanted to ask him. But what I'd like to know is, when you are sitting down in your lovely house in the New Forest, looking back on an amazing career, and just maybe having a glass of wine and musing over things, who in motor racing stays uppermost in your mind, has made the biggest impression upon you?
Stirling Moss. Yeah. Without a shadow of doubt. I mean, people ask me who's the greatest racing driver of all time, and depending on how I feel at the time, I give a different name. but Stirling is quite incredible. When you look at what he achieved in terms of being able to drive all sorts of different motor cars incredibly quick and win in them, when you think that he won what is arguably the greatest race of all time, the Mia Amelia in 1955, when you think how at the age of 80 everybody still knows Stirling Moss, notwithstanding the fact that his career finished in 1962, and he is an absolutely super bloke.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Nigel, shall we mention Eddie Irvine or not?
No, we won't mention Eddie Irvine. We won't mention Eddie Irvine. No. It occurs to me, actually, I mean, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of your last race, aren't we?
Yes.
Which was Indy.
Yes.
Right after 9/11.
Yes.
And I wondered, I mean, not that you've sort of never been to races since, but I wondered how long it took you before you didn't automatically look ahead and base your life around, now, so wait a minute, now, so that's Spa, and then we've got Fortnite, there's Monza, and then I wonder how long it was before you got used to not being at all the races.
I don't know, I find it a terribly difficult question to answer. I'm still not used to not being at all the races now. Because I'm still lucky enough to do odds and ends for the BBC and one or two other things. People ask me if I miss it, and I say, yeah, of course I miss it. If it was as important a part of your life as it was for me, and you stop doing it, you're going to miss it. And I still miss it, sadly, and I would love still to be going to all the races, and I would still love to be talking about them.
Yeah.
But the fact is that I'm an old man, and I'm I haven't got the stamina now to cope with the travel.
No, no. It's a, I mean,
you know what it's like now.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a perfect answer, Murray, because it always amazes me the number of people who do stop and do get out of it. And you say, do you miss it? No. I just simply don't understand that.
It either didn't matter to them or they're lying.
Well, exactly.
Murray, you mentioned there that Stirling Moss for you has left the biggest impression on motor racing. And, you know, as you say, he stopped in 62. I mean, you've seen so much. Is there a particular era that you remember very fondly for a particular reason?
Yes, the 80s, I think. Because you had Nigel Mansell, Nelson Piquet, Alain Prost, Ayrton Senna racing against each other, all of them world champions, none of them liking each other very much. and we had some wonderful spectacle. It was the turbo era, so it would be the 80s for me, without a doubt.
And my question, Murray. Which commentator in other spheres have you admired most over the years?
I've got a mental blank. I know exactly who I'm talking about, but I can't remember his
name.
We've
stumped him. We've done it.
No, I know the feeling, Murray.
I've got it now. Without a shadow of doubt, Bill McLaren, the rugby commentator.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Because he knew his sport intimately. And he talked about it with a deep love and passion. Mm. And I'm not a rugby enthusiast, but if ever there was a rugby match on that Bill McLaren was talking about, I would watch it simply because I knew I was going to enjoy it on account of the way he talked about it.
Apparently he used to use a pack of cards and he'd to learn all the players' numbers, and he'd just shuffle the cards and deal them out, and he'd say and go through the team just saying which team member that was with that number.
Really?
So he'd know just when he's looking at a ruck, he wouldn't need to see a face, he'd just see number 7, he'd say, oh, that's so and so. And I just found that amazing. There's video footage of him just going through the car pack, his name, and he gets one wrong, he puts it on, just keeps going.
I think the commentators who've got the hardest job are the horse racing commentators. Basically, I had to talk about 24 drivers. And if you see a red car coming towards you, You knew that it was going to be either Mansell or Prost or whoever, or Schumacher or Barrichello, and you only had to look at the driving style and the helmet to know which one it was. The horse racing people have to talk about different races with the same jockeys wearing different silks for different races on different horses, and how the heck they master all the stuff they have to talk about is beyond me.
Well, and speak also extraordinarily quickly, because it's the event's very short and there's so much to get in.
I agree.
It's amazing.
Can I just tell one story before we finish? It's about the TT races in the Isle of Man, which are so close to my heart. And at that time, my father was the lead commentator at the grandstand, and I was at Cregner Bar. And my father and I were the only two of the five commentators who actually knew anything about what we were talking about, because the other three people were BBC staff men, one of whom was a chap called David Southwood, who had a radio programme called A Seat in the Circle, and he was a film critic. So he wasn't terribly knowledgeable about motorcycle racing, and he was at Cregner Bar. And in this particular year, 1951, my father at the grandstand says, well, Jeff Duke, number 51, is due at Cregner Bar now, so over to David Southwood. And David Southwood said, perfect timing, Graham. I've just seen Jeff Duke on his wonderful Norton motorcycle come whizzing round the bend at Kate's Cottage, and he's plummeting down the hill towards me. I can see the sun glinting off his white helmet. Oh, it's a seagull. Thank you, David. We'll let you know.
On that note, we'll end what for me has been the most enjoyable of the podcasts we've done here at Motorsport Magazine. Murray, you're a joy. You're a hero.
Thank you, Rob.
You're irreplaceable, in my view. But it is my job, just before we close, to remind you of the subscription offer. I know it's a bit of a come down, but we do it. At the moment, if you subscribe to Motorsport magazine, it is £46 for 12 issues, and you will get two free DVDs, the 1960s British single-seater racing and the 1959 British Hill Climb Championship. This is a bargain, okay? So go for it. We need as many subscribers as possible. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Murray. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.